today, step two in ethical society and theological ends.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So we introduced the sort of dilemma that Christians find themselves in a world where we have an idealistic and ideological outlook that declares that God is on his throne, you know, all things are right, and so on. At the same time, acknowledging that the world is inevitably flawed in its current iteration, and that it's not easy for us to see where the solutions lie, you know, overcoming the problems that are in this world. So we introduced the basic theological conflict that's present for every believer in having to deal with those problems in the world while acknowledging that, you know, we can't just ignore them or pretend they're not there. And on the same side, we can't just put our hand to it and say, oh, well, I've done it. It's fixed now. The world is perfect now. It doesn't work that way. And one of the concepts, one of the terms that we introduced that reminds us of that hard reality is that we always have the poor with us, that statement from Jesus. And again, I know in context where that goes, you can go back and listen to the previous episode if you want to figure out all that. But the reality is that's the theological underpinning for this issue in resolving how Christians are supposed to think of our involvement in the world. And that's why we're talking about society on one side and theology on the other side and seeing them in sort of conflict with each other. And one of the things I was pointing out last time at the very end of the discussion, I would encourage you to go back and catch the previous discussion if you really want to get the context of where all this goes. I don't want to repeat all of that. But one of the most important ideas that we were talking about at the very end of it is that it's not sufficient. What we can't do is have this simplistic view that people who are evil are the people who are motivated to do evil, and the people who are good are all people who are trying to do good. The reality is different from that because most people who are doing evil are actually well-intentioned. They want to do what they believe is right. And I've spoken before about the Proverbs that make that statement. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. There are a lot of different ways to take that idea as well. But I mean this in sort of a deeper sense and an inevitable sense about human nature and how we're involved in society together. And so I mentioned at the end of the previous episode Hannah Arendt's work on the banality of evil, and I think that's an important concept to pursue. We've spoken about it many times in different episodes here. So I just want to, you know, begin today by offering what I would say is an example of the conclusion that I was drawing last time, which is what it does mean that good and evil are not about some people intending to pursue righteousness and other people intending to pursue evil. That's sort of a shallow view, and the shallowness of it, I think, can be exemplified in the abortion debate, which I consider incredibly important. And again, just pointing back at the history of our country, it's one of the easiest examples to give of where things have gone wrong. And I mentioned this just in passing last time, but in a little more detail, when you look at abortion issues, and I've covered this in entire episodes before, the cheap rhetoric is that people who are against abortion just want to control women's bodies. You know, that's what it is. And so all the pro-life people become these fang-toothed enemies of women. You know, that's, they just want to control our bodies and so on. Even though there's a perfectly reasonable argument to be made, and I believe this argument, so this sounds self-serving, but I'm going to say it on the other side in a minute too. There's a perfectly reasonable argument to be made that really a lot of people who are pro-life, a lot of people who are against abortion, just they have an empathy for little babies inside the womb, and they want to protect those lives. There is a motivation to do that. And I've covered it in long episodes before. It is true that some harm can come out of that toward women, and that should be talked about as well. But the intent isn't, I'm going to control women. Are there some people whose intent is to control women? Of course there are. There are some people whose motivations are evil. I'm not saying there's no one like that, but the vast majority of people who are, you know, trying to save children's lives are literally trying to do that. That's what their intent is. Does that mean they don't do any evil? Unfortunately not, including a person who stood in the woods decades ago and shot a doctor through his window because they performed abortions. Okay, on the other side of that one, as an example, is that people who are for abortion can be characterized as people who just love death. They love the culture of death. They want to advocate for death. I mean, they dine with Satan in the evening, and they do all of these things that just bring about the advocacy of death in our culture. So they're not advocates of a pro-death culture. Are there any of those? There probably are. Now, I know there are. There are some weird people who think death is a great thing. And there's probably some evil intention in that to begin with. So, I'm not saying there's nobody who has evil intentions, but the vast majority of people who are arguing for abortion are doing it because they're looking at women and saying, we want women to have the most liberty they can possibly have. Their intentions are good. Their motivations are for something that's good, but I would still say what they end up bringing about does include a catastrophic harm, in my view, looking at those little children who are then not protected. My point is, we can't be so shallow that we really think pointing a finger at the other side and saying, you people just want to do evil, is going to explain what's really motivating them or how we're going to live together in a society. Because we're all still going to be here at the end of the day, unless we kill each other. And that doesn't seem like a good option for most societies, by definition. So what I want to do is back up and say, so where is the real division? Where's the bifurcation that takes place in a society? And it takes place in every society. And it happens in our culture. We happen to have two political parties. We are so sort of baked into that system of two political parties. I don't see it changing anytime soon. We've had, if ever, an instigation for changing it, the instigation has been over the last 10 years, and there's been no serious movement in that direction. So I don't see it happening. It doesn't mean it can't happen. I just don't see it happening. In other cultures, they don't have a two political party. There are plenty of places where you're having to work coalitions together and form a government from people who've agreed that this party and that party are going to work together against those three parties, and that'll give us a majority, and we'll be able to blah, blah, blah. It's not about political parties, is my point, because in those cultures where there are multiple parties and they're having to negotiate together about who's going to be in authority, and in our culture where there are two political parties, there really is still a bifurcation of certain sociological and political issues that inherently comes down to that, a bifurcation, a single division into two different ways of seeing things and doing things. And it's not simple like, some are pro-death and some are pro-life. It's not simple like that. It is, I think, baked into the nature of human interactions in society. So that's what I want to talk about for a second. The political environment that everybody's going to live in once you form a society and you have the stability of a government that you're trying to organize around the interests of groups, which are political, and so on. Then you're going to end up with two different emphases. You're going to end up with one way to do it or another way to do it. And I think the division is as simple as progressives and conservatives. And I don't mean that in the narrow political sense of American politics. I mean it in the broad sense. You're going to have people who want to change things, and you're going to have people who want things to stay the same. And once you say it like that, you realize of course you can divide it into those two categories. Even if you divide it into other categories, you're still going to be able to come back and divide it into those two categories. Some people want to change the rules. Some people want to keep them the same. Some people want things in society to change. Some people want things in society to be exactly like they are right now or to go back to what they were when they were so great before. On the one side are the progressives, on the other side are the conservatives. Not complicated. There are very basic fundamental causes for progressivism and for conservatism, and they are what I just said. You know, that you want things to change, or you want things to say, are you happy with the way things are? Lo and behold, on that, you're a conservative. Do you want things to change? You're not happy with the way things are? Lo and behold, on that, you're a progressive. It's as simple as that. In the fundamental cause of progressivism or conservatism, it's easy to understand what's going on. Each of them also has an intrinsic, and I mean intrinsic, built-in harm or error to their approach. Regardless of what the issue is, there is a danger with it as well. The intrinsic harm of progressivism, I mean, you could, so like we could use medications to make this point on both sides, progressivism and conservatism. Medications, by which I mean pharmaceuticals, right? So the drug approval process. I'm not going to give any hard examples here. I mean, I'll give one because it's so old and everybody's familiar with it and there's no harm in bringing it up. But, you know, when I think the name of this drug is thalidomide. That's what it was, thalidomide. Back in the 1950s, 60s, somewhere in there, thalidomide is developed as a treatment for, if I remember correctly, cancers, certain kinds of cancers, and some other issues as well. And, you know, it was really needed, and everybody was desperate to get it. And I'm not saying there were no studies or that they didn't do the best they could at the time. I don't know what the approval process was at the time. But just like with every drug, you know, you can do studies on it for a long time before you know what the consequences are going to be. Because some drugs you give to people, not just drugs, but some chemicals, some substances, they don't have an effect for decades. You know, it just resides in the body, and like lead or aluminum has this cumulative effect on the body and the influences that it has on it. So drugs are going to be the same way. Pharmaceuticals are going to be the same way. There may be some consequence decades down the road that you don't know about. And so you have a long approval process, and that prevents people who need help now from being able to get help from the drug right now. So you have pressure from people to get the approval process done. We need more drugs. We need more pharmaceuticals out there. We need to be able to solve this problem. Why can't we apply it right now? We need to change the system, right? So progressive would be parallel with somebody who's saying, let's make the drug approval process simple so that we can get the drugs on the market, so that we can have shelves that are filled with solutions for people. Right now, we want to solve these problems. So let's change things, right? So let's make it easy to get on the market. Where a conservative would be saying, no, this is dangerous. Because when you put those drugs out there, I mean, who knows what's going to happen if you have some kind of, growth hormone in beef, for instance. And I'm giving an example outside of regular pharmaceuticals, I know. But my point is, you would say, no, let's hold off. Let's be cautious about this. We like the way things are. We wish things could be better in general, but we like the way things are. So let's keep those dangerous pharmaceuticals off the shelf as long as we can. The progressive example of the intrinsic harm is thalidomide. When you get a drug on the market and people start using it, and you're like, see, this is starting to alleviate problems, and then you end up with tens of thousands of birth defects because nobody saw that it was going to bring about these horrific birth defects in those who were pregnant or soon to be pregnant. And so you end up with the inherent harm of progressivism is you're taking huge risks because everything has unintended consequences. All the things we do have unintended consequences. And progressivism entails those unintended consequences. Maybe they'll be good. Maybe they'll be bad. We don't know. But while we're bringing about one change, other changes attend it. That's the intrinsic risk, harm, or error that's going to come with progressivism. Conservatism has the same kind of intrinsic problem, that when you're holding on to one thing that is really valuable, you might be holding on to, and inevitably you are holding on to, because things are systemically tied together. You will be holding on to other things that are harmful in a society. And I wouldn't even say that if I thought we could live in a utopia. Conservatism wouldn't have an inherent harm if we could live in a utopia. But there are no utopias. There are no perfect societies right now. It's part of our theology that we understand that every society has the poor. Every society has evil in it somewhere. And it, to the extent that we conserve our current society, then we conserve the evils of our current society. That's intrinsic to conservatism. So again, not attacking conservatism or progressivism. I'm making the point that both are inherently appealing for a reason, and both are inherently flawed for a reason. Now, this does not, again, I'm not trying to come at this as a pessimist. That's not my goal. I'm not being apocalyptic. I'm not just giving up on all of hope. I'm trying to say, what are we supposed to do as people who can't just be satisfied with saying, yeah, people are suffering, but the world stinks, so you know, Jesus can't do anything about that. We can't do that. Obviously, that's just nonsensical. Jesus doesn't throw up his hands in despair when he looks at the world. And on the other hand, we can't pretend to do what Jesus himself did not do while he was here, which is alleviate all of human suffering. We can't pretend like we have the universal solution that, well, you know, Jesus wasn't quite able to get it done in his life, but I think this guy can if we can just get him elected. That's just not a realistic option for us. So the political environment requires those two things, and I just want us to understand and think about where they actually go a little more deeply. So on the progressive side, let's talk about it for a minute, where, you know, progressivism goes to give more detail to it. The fundamental cause of progressivism, like I said, is this underlying sentiment that the current distribution of something, you know, it could be wealth, it could be comfort, could be justice, could be liberty, could be whatever, but that the current distribution of something is not okay. It's not satisfactory. So we need a change. And that can be motivated selfishly. Like, my group is being excluded from justice, and so we're going to stand up, and we're going to revolt, and we're going to have riots until you do it, and, you know, no peace until there's peace for everyone, and so on. That's fine. And I say the word selfish. I really just mean egoistic. It can be motivated, you know, by an uprising of the labor class who are going to say, we expect more from our society than just to treat us like slaves and so on. Or literally from slaves who say, we're not going to be treated like subhumans anymore. So it could be a selfish motivation, an egoistic motivation, and not be evil, but be a desire for some better distribution of justice that includes us. It could also be altruistic, and this is often the case. Progressives can be people who are looking at a class of people who are currently excluded and saying, I don't think we should treat them that way, and I want to do something to change that society. Now, is there any hypocrisy in either of those? Sure, there can be. There can be a lot of self-dealing in a selfish approach, and there can be a false sense of empathy among those who abuse a subordinated class for their own power benefit. Of course there can be that, but there can also be legitimate motivations to say, I think every human being ought to be treated as a human being, and so I'm going to stand up and say, I'm a human being, treat me like one. Or I can say, I think every human being ought to be treated like a human being, and so I want you to start treating that class of people better, and I want to change the laws regarding them, and so on. So that's a fundamental cause of progressivism. And the change, you know, is intended to alleviate the problem. And when I'm talking about progressives in this case, I mean alleviate the problem politically. And as I mentioned, the harm that comes with that, that's sort of built into it, the problem that comes to it, is the applied reality of it. And I think this it accompanies the truth. Now, this is where I think the real challenge of progressivism is always going to come in. In any society, no matter how you try to apply it. And again, I'm going to do the same thing with conservatism. I'm not picking a side here. I'm trying to say why we as Christians have to think more circumspectly. And I mean that word in its prime sense right now, all the way around the perimeter of this. We have to think more circumspectly about this if we're going to handle it correctly as followers of Christ. And so the change that's intended here politically by progressives has the inherent harm or the intrinsic harm that I think goes with the statement, the way we have applied it now, that the poor are always with you. That is, that every solution involves harming one group in order to help another group. And I'm not saying it's designed to do that. I'm just saying it's built into it that that's what happens. And I'm not trying to be shallow about the economics of it or anything like that, but in progressive approaches, there is a sense that at the end of the day, somebody's going to have to give something up in order for this other group to be benefited. And I'm not even saying that because progressives errantly have a communistic or a socialist outlook on life. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that's what is intended at all. But I am saying just the nature of our existence together in society puts us in a position where that's what comes out of it. And it's not always immediate. It's not something that would always follow immediately. But just pragmatically, it's going to happen. And pragmatically, and this is the really creepy part, historically, this plays out in reality. The really sad part of it is that pragmatically, it results in what, you know, for, and I think, I don't know, I, you know, you'll be surprised to hear this. I don't hang around a lot of women's groups. I don't sit in a lot of conversations with just a group of women and hear what they're talking about. But I know how men talk about these things. I know how we have conversations about it. And as I get older and older, I know how older, more experienced, so what most people would say are wiser, I don't think it's necessarily true, men say about it. And I suspect women have the same kind of conversations about something like this. And I'm not saying we can have conversations together, but I'm just saying the historical, and you can say patriarchal or misogynistic or whatever, that maybe that's the case too. I don't think it matters what the motivations are. I think at the end of the day, men learn over time. We're taught by other men over time that at some point you have to grow up, stop being childish, stop thinking you can take care of everybody's need, and realize that you're going to have to make some hard choices, which means you're going to have to hurt some people if you want to help some people. And you've got to be willing to turn off that sensitive part of you that says, I don't want to hurt that person. Nah, you just get used to it. It's sort of the farm mentality. You get used to cutting the animal's throat and you stop being empathetic about it. Well, sometimes you're just going to have to hurt some people. It's the Mitt Romney, I like firing people kind of way of thinking about things. I'm not even condemning Mitt Romney. I think he was abused in the conversation about his rhetoric regarding that discussion. But I don't care. That's not the point. The point is, all of us have heard this, and I know that in progressive conversations, and historically, everybody knows this. This is where it leads. Ultimately, if you say, we're willing to give up any of the conservative strictures of contemporary society, we're willing to get rid of all of the conservative, the traditional view of how society is structured and so on, then very often those barriers that, you know, to removing those structures that are keeping society the way it is, which is harming those people over there, and it probably is harming those people over there, those barriers are other people, and they eventually become viewed as something that needs to be removed. If you want to look at it in its most tragic form, then you look at, and I mean this literally, in the history of Russia, you look at the history, you look at the October Revolution, you look at the overthrow of the dynasties or the czars or whatever, and you see not just individuals who are being punished for injustices they performed, but classes of people being annihilated because they are a barrier to bringing equality to other people. And it's not, and again, I'm just picking that one example because I know, because I've done a lot on Soviet history and just out of my dissertation and things like that. And I know the reality of it there. But it happened in other societies as well. It happened at the same period of time, mid-20th century. It happened in Germany in the same way. And in a lot of European society, including in Italy, it happens with, and so on. So you just, historically, there is a huge risk of that. And there's always some kind of trade-off that's going to go on like that. Whether it's that harsh and brutal or not, it does involve some kind of trade-off. Okay, well, that's not to say, well, then you can't do anything progressive, obviously. That's just pure evil. That's simplistic because conservatives run into the same kind of problem. So the fundamental cause of conservatism, as I mentioned, is the idea that things are right or at least headed in the right direction. And where it might be selfish, for instance, I mean, this is how my papa, who was not, and my papa, that's what we called my grandfather on my dad's side. My papa was not a conservative at all. He grew up, you know, lived through the Great Depression. And so in his mind, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and all the changes he brought to American culture and society through his policies were the salvation of the country. I mean, he and Papa literally sat there on the front, on his back porch and told me We would have starved to death if it weren't for FDR and for the things that he did to rescue the poor man, you know. And what he had in mind with that was, and he said this, this is why all the Republicans, they're the big businessmen, they're the millionaires, they're the people who already have the money. That caricature on his part, but it's not entirely wrong, that caricature on his part is based on the premise that the conservatives are the people who have things going well for them. Well, of course they are. I mean, that's the point. We want to keep things the way they are. We're comfortable with the way things are right now. So it can be selfish like that. I like my slice of the pie. I don't want the laws to change. I want things to be the way they are right now. That can be the case. It can also be altruistic. Very often there are people who very sincerely, for one thing, believe the rhetoric of the people who are described above, you know, the sort of shallow characters in the conservative model. They believe that rhetoric, but also they believe the promises that are sort of built into the system, that the trickle-down economics, you know, of a Reagan or a George H.W. Bush, that kind of way of thinking of the economic system. Look, yeah, they may suffer right now, and they may be excluded by systems of injustice right now, but the reality is if we can create a more free, a freer system economically, which allows those who currently have the resources to keep them, by the way, but if we can do that, then we create an environment where anybody who gets into those resources can keep them and multiply them, and everybody becomes more prosperous. And that's why the typical conservative argument economically, which I don't think is a completely unreasonable argument, the typical conservative argument economically is, if you want to find the systems that have alleviated the most poverty in the world, they are the systems that have maximized liberty in the world. Now, whether that's defensible or not, you can have all the arguments about it and whatever, but it's not a completely unreasonable claim. Yet, and built into that is the fundamental cause of conservatism. If you'll just stay with the system, if you'll just stay with the way things are, it will be okay. All right, so whether it's selfish or altruistic, it's still there. The preservation, just like above with progressivism, the change was intended to alleviate a problem, right? Politically alleviate a problem. The preservation here, conservatism, that's what the word is. We're trying to preserve things, conserve things. Preservation, or even reversion, let's get back to the way we were before, it's intended to maintain the current balance of power. We think things are in the best place for everyone's benefit if things are distributed the way they are right now. Therefore, the intrinsic harm of conservatism, just like I gave the intrinsic harms of progressivism above, is that there are always people who are excluded from the things that are being preserved. That's part of the meaning. You always have the poor with you, right? I mean, that's just built into it. So if every society includes suffering by our theological understanding of human existence right now, if every society includes suffering and excluded people, then conservatism only makes sense up to the boundaries beyond which that suffering and exclusion are experienced. If, you know, if you're in the part of the world that doesn't experience all the suffering and exclusion, then of course, let's keep it like this and let's just invite other people to join us. But if you're in the part of the world that is excluded, which our theology says there are always people who are excluded, if that's the case, then obviously the conservatism doesn't make a lot of sense to them, because to this point, they haven't been able to cross the line. To this point, they haven't gotten into the system. So it's sort of inherent that this is the point. It's an intrinsic harm of conservatism that it doesn't make sense beyond that line. Conservatives, for as an example, oppose DEI. I hear this everywhere, all of the time. I did a couple of episodes a while back on diversity and inclusion and why we need to think about them differently. I would encourage you to go back and listen to that. We talked about affirmative action, all the things in higher education that were involved in that, and I think it's worth the conversation. I would encourage you to go and listen to that for details. But here on this, I mean, this is a really strong part of the contemporary present day conservative movement, is opposition to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. If I don't spend time talking with individuals who I have done this, because I've met individuals who have been identified and persecuted and excluded because of their minority status their entire lives. I've had those conversations. If I don't have those conversations, then I wouldn't know anything about who's kept on the other side of that line, or why, in their minds at least, something fundamental needs to change in order for things to be made right. So as an example, when I'm speaking, and I've shared this before, but when I'm speaking with African Americans, and I make this statement, I say, I know that when I see police lights in my rearview mirror, I don't have the same reaction that an African American man is going to have when he sees those lights in his rearview mirror. And I don't mean to exclude women there. That an African American would have when they see those police lights there. I don't have it. I don't have the same conversations with my kids about what that means. I don't have the same anxiety or fear or wondering about where this is ultimately going to lead. I just think, oh, bummer, I'm about to lose 15 or 20 minutes and I'm going to have to pay $50 or $150 or $500 for something or another. No, it doesn't happen every day, and I don't know that experience very often at all. Thank you for your judgmentalism. Anyway, the point is, I don't have the same experience. When I share that with African Americans, the only thing I get back from them is nodding and acquiescence. Man, you got that right. You don't see it the same way as I do at all. And man, I could just give you story after story that even very conservative black men have told me about what they have endured at the hands of law enforcement just because they were black men driving in a white neighborhood, for instance. So it's just stunning. And you wouldn't think about it if you don't have the conversation with them. So in this context, conservatives, this is interesting, isn't it? Conservatives wanted that. And I find this a strange thing about us. We don't acknowledge that we're not really conservative about everything. When Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, we weren't conservative about that. We want that overturned. But we don't think of it that way. We think of it as a reversion to the land before there was Roe v. Wade so that we could get back to where we were before. That's our way of characterizing it. But you can see that even in a conservative mindset, we recognize that we don't want to conserve everything. We want to conserve the good things. We want to hang on to the good things. And you would think that we would say, oh, well, and progressives are probably the same way. You know, they want things to change, but they don't want everything to change. They just want some things to change. So, it depends on how conservative, how progressive you are, I guess, as to how that applies. So, for instance, if I'm talking about Roe v. Wade, for conservatives don't want, they want Roe v. Wade overturned. So we finally get Roe v. Wade overturned. Finally, we have this new law of the land. And we don't think about the fact that in the black community, there is a history, a long history, hundreds of years long history, of women being used literally in the slave trade for impersonal breeding. Your body was not your own. And we don't think about what it means in that community to hear someone saying, you don't have a choice about this reproductive decision. Now, again, I'm not having the whole conversation. I'm pro-life. I am in favor of protecting the lives of every little baby in the womb. I think we ought to see them as human beings and offer them the protection that human beings get. But surely we could look, deeply enough into the community that was treated as chattel and recognize that someone could feel threatened as if their body is being turned into a container again and no longer just their own, and recognize that there is a risk in conservatism that we conserve the prejudices or the harms that were accompanying the society that we only think of in terms of its golden values because we weren't on the harmed side, whether it's in the black community or not. In any community where there's a history of not being able to make a decision yourself about reproduction or health without your husband's approval or without your parents' approval, then you can understand where there literally are cases where a husband or a father rapes a woman, and then he's the person that they had to go to historically to get approval or authority or to be able to make a decision about what's going to happen with the child who is a product of that abuse. If we can't hear those voices, then we wouldn't recognize the inherent tension, at least, that exists with some conservative ways of seeing things. And again, I was making the same observations on the other side about progressivism and the harms that we might not recognize are going to come to some people. So, you know, for conservatives to oppose overturning, you know, this is among progressives, obviously, but I'm saying they're really conservatives. During the years when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, people who were pro-choice were conservative. They wanted to keep the law the way that it was. So conservatives were opposing the overturning of Roe v. Wade. But we've made it so shallow and political, and now it's just, you know, it's just you're a Republican or you're a Democrat. That makes you a conservative or a progressive. That's not how I'm using the terms. That's why I'm pointing this out. The harm that comes with the conservatism of opposing the overturning of Roe v. Wade is 50 million little lives that were completely wiped out. That one's obvious to me, so I won't dwell on it. So it seems like this is how we feel about it and how we'd like for it to be. It seems like we should be able to conserve right up to the boundary, you know? So we want to conserve all the good things where all the helps are present and then see the line where the suffering begins and say, no, 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 we stop here. We don't want to conserve that. So we want to conserve all of this economic liberty, but we don't want to conserve the racism. We don't want that. We don't want that. So we're going to conserve up to this boundary, see where the harms begin, and then we'll try to create legislation that's designed just particularly to conserve only up to that point and not beyond it. But we don't realize how inevitable the trade-off is. And I don't just mean that economically. Again, I'm not trying to be shallow economically about it. But I mean socially, that it's inevitable that there is a trade-off. So, and the example, and I gave this example when we talked about affirmative action a long time ago, you know, the example of race-based admissions in college is perfect. It conveys the idea perfectly. Because affirmative actions are right. I mean, they do make sense. And they make sense and they seem great, especially for those who formerly been excluded. And again, listen to the whole show for the underpinning to this, because there I know all the conservative arguments against affirmative action, but there's lots of solid grounding for understanding test scores and everything else differently when you really think through it. And I'm saying this as a person who's been involved in Christian higher education and higher education in general for decades. So I don't have any doubt that there's an advantage to it. At the same moment, you know, you can say, oh, well, look, there's an advantage. We're finally having a higher minority presence in higher education. That's fantastic. And then suddenly realize that your daughter doesn't get a spot even though she had higher test scores. And that doesn't seem right. You know, they've only got so many spots and now they're giving them away. And so my daughter who made a better test score, this didn't happen to me. I'm making it up, right? My daughter who made a better test score, she's being excluded because of it. And so now this is where I will insert just a tiny bit of defensiveness for affirmative action for a second here, because never mind that the tests are residual of all of the mechanisms which have excluded members of the diversity effort to start with. The testing, you know, is designed to reinforce the things that have been taught in the society that you're trying to conserve to begin with. So part of affirmative action is just having to acknowledge that our testing is not perfect either, and that the systems that equip students to be able to take that test are not perfect either, perfectly distributed either. So it wouldn't make sense to say, well, we're still just going to use perfect iteration of test scores to do this. You wouldn't be addressing any problem if you did that. But because of that, you know, here's your daughter who did all of the work. She did everything she was supposed to do. She didn't have any prejudice in her mind when she was doing it. And she passed all the tests and got the right scores, and then she gets excluded from school anyway. And what do we call that? Reverse discrimination. Remember the language that we used? So we call it reverse discrimination, which is really, now just think about this, because I'm trying to explain the difference between conservatism and progressivism right now. Not trying to attack one or the other. I'm trying to attack both. I'm trying to say both have weaknesses. But I'm just choosing this one because it's so familiar to us. So we call it reverse discrimination. Oh, so now you're excluding white people because they're white, because her test score said she should have been included. So the term reverse discrimination is really just a clever way of saying this. I want to go back to excluding the people we were able to ignore before all this fuss began. That's what I want. The reverse discrimination is a way of saying when you started including those people who were formerly excluded, when you started including them, you started excluding some of the people who used to be included. And I don't like that. That's reverse discrimination, which means literally, I just want to go back to excluding the same people we were excluding before. That's the point of conservatism. I don't mean I want to be evil and keep those people out. I mean the side of it that says, look, things were going fine before. We worked hard. We took the tests. We got the scores. We paid the money. And we got the reward of our hard work. What on earth is wrong with that? Nothing, if you don't see beyond the line where people are being excluded. So you can see how there's an intrinsic tension between the two, right? So, and that's just an example. Conflicts between individuals and groups in any society are why we have governments. They're why we have laws. They're why we have structures and norms, whether they're encoded or not. They're all present because a society exists by having tensions and pressures between different individuals and groups within that society. So you have to have some kind of standard set, some kind of rules, some kind of enforcement, and so on, for the restrictions that we put on it, and those inevitably favor some over others because the world's not perfect. Not because people say, oh, I just want white people to get theirs. It's not got to be that. It can be that. Again, there are some evil people. I generally caricature those people by calling them stupid, but they're not. They're not always, but they can be literally evil. That's not the norm of society. And that's not the median of society that you ever have to deal with. They're present, and we all have to be aware of them, but they're way out there. And nobody on either side seriously respects them when you're in the middle. So in the middle, this huge bulk of us, you know, we're trying to get to something better one way or the other. And the one way is by change, and the other way is by not changing. And how we pressure those two things together, how we press those two things together and come to a conclusion as a society is what our political structures all look like right now. So what I want us to think about, oh my goodness, I've already used up the time for this episode. So that's all just foundation to get to the point of the change I think Jesus brings to the ethic that his followers are supposed to have. We're supposed to see something different in the way we address problems. And whether it's, you know, the problem of being able to conserve the world the way it is or being able to change the world to the way it ought to be, whichever way you define the problem or see the problem, we're supposed to see it differently and we're supposed to respond to it differently because we're followers of Christ. Anybody who is a follower of Jesus knows that ought to be the case. There shouldn't be anything Jesus doesn't radically change in us. And so what I want to do is follow that line of thought in a third, apparently, discussion about society and the reality of where the pressures of our real society come together with the pressures of our very firmly convicted theology that we don't live in a perfect world, and yet we believe in a perfect Lord who has power in this world. What is it he wants to do with us in that world? More on that next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.